This broadcast of the Diane Rehm Show is recorded, so we're not taking any new phone calls.
Thanks for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. Julie Andrews once said at The Sound of Music, "What can you do with nuns, seven children, and Austria?" She and co-star Christopher Plummer managed to make it one of the top-grossing movies of all time. Although it launched his film career, Christopher Plummer has always been more at home on the stage. In a new memoir, he discusses his love of theater, tumultuous personal life, and why it took him years to appreciate his role as Captain Von Trapp. His new book is titled In Spite of Myself, and Christopher Plummer joins me in the studio. And throughout the hour, we'll look forward to hearing your questions, comments. Join us on 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Welcome.
Thank you so much,
Dad. So glad to have you here.
Oh, it's nice to be here. I love radio, so.
You began in radio.
Yes.
Where?
We began in Montreal. I played in both French and English radio. And then Toronto, which then in the 40s had the best radio drama in the world. we were in exchange with the BBC Third Program in those days. And we had a group of marvelous writers and actors who all had at least 25 different voices to their credit stormed the airways and gave Canada, certainly, perhaps the most original and identifiable art form it has had, actually, other than the paintings.
You indeed describe yourself as a spoiled brat of a kid.
Yes.
Talk about that childhood.
Have you read the book, by the way?
I have.
You have?
I have.
God bless you. How long did it take?
Long time.
Yes.
Long time.
Now, don't be rude.
I won't.
I promise that...
You got very personal in the book.
Well, I think you have to. I don't believe in people who write their autobiographies or memoirs who sort of shy away from deep secrets and keep them secrets. I think if you're going to have the guts to write the damn thing in the first place, you've got to be honest. And I'm as honest as I can be in the book, I think. I certainly self-deprecate myself because I am worthy of self-deprecation, if ever there was one.
But that childhood, tell me about it.
Well, the childhood, my family did spoil me. I mean, I grew up in sort of rarefied circumstances.
An only child.
And my great-grandfather had been the Prime Minister of Canada, and he also was the author of the charter that built the Canadian Pacific Railroad, and he owned railroads, and so it was a different atmosphere in those days to most actors who grow up from the streets. Mm. I had to grow down from an Edwardian living room to the streets. But the reason I did so, it was rather good that I had that barrier to fight, because it finally gave me the anger that's necessary to be an artist. Artists always have to have some anger.
Of course.
And there was none, particularly in that genteel family.
Except that your father left your mother when you were an infant.
Yes, which I knew nothing about because I was one. So I didn't meet my father until many years later when I was about 18. That was a sort of rather scary moment. He was perfectly nice, but it was difficult to communicate because mother had played both roles of father and mother, you know, and had.
What had you heard about him from your mother?
Well, the marriage, don't forget, this is in the 20s, and divorce was not done. And she lost a whole bunch of very devoted friends because they disapproved of her divorce. Poor mother only had one or two staunch ones who really stuck by her. Society ostracized people who were divorced, and particularly in colonial North America, because it was sort of a hangover from the past. England wasn't quite as bad because it had grown up. But Canada and the States remained. It was a shocking thing to do. So she had to bear an awful lot of criticism. And that hurt me. It didn't make me suffer because she spoiled me rotten, as which was she was terrific. But it hurt me later. And it did. I did realize how thankless I probably had been in not understanding what she was going through. Because I was young and didn't know and probably didn't give a damn. But suddenly her death made me realize, as death always does, God, what I could have done if I'd had my, you know, for her, to thank her for what she'd done for me. It's always too late.
How old was she when she died?
She was only 65. Mm. Yeah, and she'd had a slight stroke and hit her head on the bathtub, and it was as swift and as quick as that. I was not there. I was in New York in a play.
And you actually went to the mortuary.
Yeah, I went to the mortuary and was left alone with her. That was my first and probably last experience with death that really meant something. And it was very strange. It was, I say in my book, one didn't know what to say left alone in a room with a corpse of your mother lying there. And I suddenly the memories came back, and I could hear her reading Peter Pan to me, as she always did. And that wonderful line from Peter Pan that she loved so much herself, to die will to die will be such a big adventure. And I think she always believed that. And that cheered me a little.
And then you kissed her.
Yes, I kissed her. It was, I described it, the only way I could describe it was like kissing cold marble. And I knew that she'd gone.
Christopher Plummer, he has acted on stage and screen for 6 decades, earning 2 Tony and Emmy Awards. He recently starred in Caesar and Cleopatra and plays Leo Tolstoy in the upcoming film The Last Station. Do join us, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. As I said, you just finished playing Julius Caesar at the Stratford Shakespeare Festival. What was that experience like for you?
Well, it's the play that I wanted to do for a long time. You know, there are, once you get into my great age, I'm 78 now, that you have to be sort of rather selective about what you want to play. And there are only a few, Methuselah, God, perhaps, Prospero in the Tempest, and perhaps a Falstaff if you still have the strength. And the big light comedies like Shaw. You could play Undershaft, I suppose, and Major Barbara. And there are a few parts, so I latched on to Caesar. And years ago, and I took it to the boys at Stratford, I could never find a director who wanted to do it. Why, I can't imagine, except that I think they think Shaw is too flippant and too, and will then therefore make them look shallow if they do it. I don't know, they have some real problem with Shaw. And Des McAnuff, who has taken over the Stratford Festival now, who is one of the hottest directors in the world on the theater stage, loved it and said, let's do it. So I was absolutely thrilled. And he's given it a marvelous production. And we got terrific press from both America and Canadian critics. And it turned out to be such a modern play. It's so strange. It was written in 1898, and yet the whole business of Iraq just stands out quite openly and resonantly right there in the play itself. He says quite clearly, I should not have come to Egypt, he says that for a second, and we wonder where that echo takes us.
At 78, what is it like for you to memorize your lines?
Interesting. I try very, very, very much to, if I make speeches, which I'm called upon to do, poor bleeding audience, I try to learn them. I don't like reading cards or doing, just to keep the, you know, that memory going.
Absolutely.
Because I'm terrified that, you know, one day it may disappear. So I learn the play before I arrive at the first rehearsal. Now, I used to. I used to be, you know, gung-ho. I don't care. Maybe at the dress rehearsal I'll drop the script and surprise them. Not anymore. I really have to learn. I learned the whole of Lear before I stepped onto the stage. You have to at our age. Not your age. Our age, meaning...
I'm getting close.
Meaning the royal we.
The royal we. Well, it does seem to me that you must keep that memory so sharp.
Yeah.
And you must exercise that process.
Of course, also what helps, Diane, is the fact that I love words. And I want to get them right. Because when they are right, there's such wonderful color in words. And the masters, like Shaw, like Shakespeare, and like Johnson, and like all the great poets, it sort of helps to love it, because then it comes right into your memory bank.
Christopher Plummer, most recently he starred in Caesar and Cleopatra at the Stratford Shakespeare Festival. He plays Leo Tolstoy in the upcoming film, The Last Station, his new book, In Spite of Myself. And Christopher Plummer is with me. We are talking about many things, including his latest performance at the Stratford Shakespeare Festival, where he played Julius Caesar. Here is an email on exactly that from Sue in Clarkston, Michigan. She says, my husband and I were lucky to attend a performance of Caesar and Cleopatra at the Stratford Festival in Stratford, Ontario last month, starring Christopher Plummer. It was a stunning performance. We wished we would have had a chance to encourage others to attend, but it was the very end of the season in Stratford. Now I understand. The festival has produced a video that will be shown on Bravo and probably also available to purchase from the festival. Is that so?
Yes. I hope it works. Usually I don't like films of plays because the two never meet. The two art forms really never meet. You put a barrier between the audience and the meaning of theater just goes out the window. But in this case, we had to do it with the laughs. I mean, I couldn't imagine how deadly it would have been to film it with no laughing from there. So we did several shots of the audience laughing at certain lines and stuff. So it showed the viewer that it was not just an intimate little exchange, but when we opened up, we were in a theater and doing it. So I think it'll work very well. It was covered very, very carefully.
How do you think that kind of process, that dual process, might have affected or infected your own performance?
Oh, not at all, because, in fact, so many years on the screen, I know how to pull down when it's needed, and there's so many little intimate scenes in the play that are probably more effective at close range than they are in the theater. So those were covered very close, and then you pull away for the big stuff, and the audience is sitting there laughing.
Here's an email from Doris, who says, of all of Mr. Plummer's roles, my favorite is as the narrator of the Madeline series. What a wonderful, evocative voice my daughters and I will always treasure.
How nice.
Tell me about doing that narration, how you felt about that.
Well, it's pretty disembodied when you're narrating something. I thought it was charmingly done, that little film, and I loved the drawings. I thought the drawings were wonderfully unfinished. You know, they were perfect. And I thought it was well written. I thought my part was extremely well written, and I loved narrating it. What more can I say? Because I was not a part of it. I'm sitting all alone in a studio reading off these lines. But I enjoyed it thoroughly, and it was a huge success, and I wish it had gone on, but something always happens to these things.
Now, I want to go back a ways, because you talked about your spoiled childhood, your doting mother, the luxury in which you lived. How did she react to your ambitions to go into the
theater?
Oh,
she was all for it, you know. Some of the elder members of the family, my grandmother and mother, were all rather impatient with a young man trying to be an actor. They thought that was very...
How hard was it?
Very common indeed. What?
How hard was it to get into the theater?
Well, I did all I could in Quebec. I went ahead and did it. Nothing was going to stop me. And as I was so bad at school... And rather bored at school, and even bored when I took an extra English course at McGill University in Montreal. But I hammered away, and of course in those days, a lot of people thought, well, you were awfully good in that play, but what do you do for a living? And I said, well, I am doing it for a living, you schmuck. But so it was a constant battle. But finally, I had to leave the country. I did this wonderful radio in Toronto for a while when Andrew Allen was the head director, an absolute genius, and he brought such wonderful things to the air. We did all the Dickens, we did W.H. Auden, we did T.S. Eliot, we did everything on the air in those days with full orchestra, with a composer who composed stylish music for each one. That was a wonderful, wonderful couple of years. And then television reared its ugly head, and radio began to sort of, radio drama of that caliber began to take a back seat, sadly. And everybody was now, the government was now all behind television, and radio was a forgotten medium.
Only to reemerge with strength and glory.
Yes, I know. But it didn't for a while. And those people who had been involved in it, those clever writers, people like Lister Sinclair and Reuben Ship and Tommy Tweed, and all satirists who were who knew that Canada at that time needed goosing and needed to have an injection of humor into its veins, because it was going through a rather complacent post-war period of depression, saved it, really, made us laugh at ourselves, and that was terribly important.
And speaking of laughing at oneself, the first sentence of your book, I was brought up by an Airedale.
Yes.
Clearly, a love of dogs there, yeah. But clearly
yes,
a fair
right
amount
away.
Of humor.
Yes, yes. Yes, I was, and I really did think that there was that, because for ages I didn't know who the tall lady was pushing my pram until somebody pointed out it was my mother. Oh, I said, sorry. I thought it was him. Old Bing, my dog. Because, of course, he was so big and I was so small that I couldn't see past him. So all I saw was Bing. But it sure made me love animals. And Bing started it all off. Yeah, and I've had many dogs ever since, and a whole family of dogs, which I also bore the reader to tears with in a couple of chapters, because, except the dog lovers, and they all died. My wife and I had never been around a family of dogs. It's quite interesting when you are part of the family. They deigned to let us be part of their pack. And we were very servile and very, very low down on the pecking order.
Did you always prefer Airedales, or did
No, not necessarily. It just happened that it was such an odd breed to bring up a child, and I thought, and I was thankful that the word itself suggests great humor. Airedales are not usually thought of generally, immediately when the word dog comes to mind. An Airedale does not come to mind. It's usually a dear soppy golden retriever or something. But I thought there was something quite original about Airedale.
I think there is something quite original about the title of your book.
I'm glad you like it. Or do you? I mean,
I do like it. I want to understand how you arrived at it.
Oh, my God. Now, you ought to know how difficult. You've probably written more than one book.
Two.
Well, you know how tough it is to think of a title. It's actually harder than writing the book. And I just was going to give up and let my editor do it. Oh, for God's sake. I mean, I had 600, which I'm sure you did, names scrolled down, trying to be funny in some, trying to be over-sentimental in others, trying to be taken too seriously as a writer, which I really wanted to be taken seriously as, but I didn't want to push it in the title. And then suddenly I thought of a wonderful title that Simon Brett, the mystery writer, suddenly thought of one day. He was talking about an actor and a memoir, and the actor's memoir was entitled Not Dead, Just Resting. And I thought, I'm going to steal that title, damn it. I mean, who the hell knows who Simon Brett is anyway? Only about five or six of my friends. And I said, no, you can't do that. That's awful. Come on, be original. And then I thought, well, why, I'm going to call it. So I called up Vicki Wilson, my editor at Knopf. I said, Vicki, I've got the title, and please don't change it. Just accept it.
Just
for
do
God's
it.
Sake. And here it is. It's A Gypsy in Spite of Myself. And she said, in a flash, she said, what about Just in Spite of Myself? You see, already the editorial mind slashing away at
of
my
course.
Genius.
Of course. Of course.
So, and
but, you know, there's a little bit of a double entendre there.
Oh, yeah. I intended
and
that.
That's what I want to understand.
Well, what it means is that I did a few things that I perhaps might be proud of in my life. In spite of my self-destructive nature, which always had to be brought to the fore. And I'm very glad I had a self-destructive nature, because it made me self-deprecating. And there's nothing worse or more boring than somebody who is always in love with themselves and in praise of themselves. And nothing more boring than an autobiography that just goes on and on and on, overindulging itself in self-aggrandizing, and it's good to knock yourself.
Help me to understand that self-destructive nature.
Ah, that's easy. Hell of a lot of booze and a love for same. I didn't drink because I was suffering. I drank because I was having a lot of fun drinking. And I joined a group of people who had the same feeling that I did. And, of course, I became quite seriously, I suppose, not a out-and-out alcoholic, but I was certainly fried most of my youth. And I was still able to go on and play Hamlet and do all sorts of things hungover until after the show. I never drank during the show, by the way. Always before and after. I can't imagine why one is alive today, what we went through in those 50s. The 50s, it was fashionable to drink, and drugs hadn't really become fashionable quite yet in our society. And so we reveled in this kind of camaraderie of booze, rather like an army of fellas going out to fight and drinking. And the more, I bet you can't play Hamlet all through on a matinee still drunk. And if you can, you'll be a man, my son. You know, it's that kind of challenge. And that was very much my pals that I, who were Jason Robards and Peter O'Toole and sometimes Richard Burton and Richard Harris, were all of that ilk. And I was desperately led down the path.
You didn't go voluntarily.
No,
of course not. Of course not. And your own very personal life led you in rather intense personal directions.
Yes, and what do you mean by that? What do you mean by that, Diane?
The extent to which you elaborate on your various loves.
Oh.
And love experiences in this book is, I would say, rather surprising.
Oh, you don't think that... you don't think I'm a lover, huh? Okay, Diane. That's it. I'm going. No, I think you have to... I think I had to talk about people because they're all my friends, the ones that are still alive. They're all my friends. All the affairs that I had with terrific girls, I was lucky, are still my friends. And I don't think any of them would be offended that I, in some cases, named them.
At 26 before the hour, you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. And, of course, you have been married 3 times.
Yes.
Your third wife, you say... You hope.
Oh,
you pray.
The first two were terrific rehearsals. 5 years each, absolutely to the dot. And this one, what, 38?
Yeah. Have you learned how to be a husband?
From long coaching by my dearest friend in the world, my wife, Elaine. She coached me.
It's not easy.
No. But if you're married to Elaine... It isn't particularly hard, because she lets you hang yourself every day and watches with the most extraordinary glee on her face. I think what saved us was every time we early on when we used to have passionate fights, we could never carry them through. We always broke up at the end. You know, we always fell on the floor laughing. At the sound of our voices, we couldn't believe that we were so hammy and bad. And because she was an actress, of course, we'd say, oh, my God, how you ever got a job? I don't know, because you're so damn unconvincing. And I mean, it was fun. And I think humor saved the day, most of all.
And children?
Well, I had Amanda. That was my first, Tammy Grimes and I had Amanda, my first marriage. And I didn't see Amanda for ages, rather like the gap that I didn't meet my father. And I make that a kind of... similar period of my life in the book. And so I really met her for the first time as a talking human being when she was 18. So it'd been a long time. I was in Europe. Tammy and I were divorced, you must understand. I mean, our marriage was over. I was sending Amanda to school in America, in New York. But I was living in Europe with my second wife. And then I met Amanda, and she didn't know what she was going to be. She was a marvelous horseback rider. I mean, jumper. She in fact, she taught. She was hired in the Vanderbilt stables. She looked after those racing horses of the Vanderbilts for quite a while, and trained them. And, I mean, she was a real little jockey. She's tiny. She's got those small bones, and she can sit on a horse like she belongs. So I never knew what she wanted to be, and suddenly she tried everything and dropped out of everything, and then said, oh, all right, I'll become a ham like my parents, I suppose. Oh, God. And it was the last thing she wanted to do. But she did it and ground her teeth. And then I went and saw her in Taste of Honey in New York. And my God, I thought, she's absolutely extraordinary. And then I saw her in Agnes of God 2 years later, in which she was terrifying. And she won the Tony. She got every prize known to man. The critics just went over the top. But more important than that was, here was someone that I was looking at that had no bearing on Tammy, her mother, or myself, her father. I mean, where did she get this original kind of fury that can terrify an audience like she can? It's unbelievable. And I was terrified that she might do some bodily harm to herself. She was so physical and passionate on the stage. It was a very exciting time, and it made her even stranger to me than ever. It took an awfully long time for me to say hi, Amanda, afterwards.
Christopher Plummer. His new book, a memoir, is titled In Spite of Myself. When we come back, we'll open the phones, take your email, 800-433-8850.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by Vicki and Roger Sant and Island Press, which provides solutions to environmental problems in print, in person, and online at islandpress.org. By the Doris Duke Charitable Foundation, supporting the performing arts, environmental conservation, medical research, and the prevention of child abuse. And by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. This is NPR.
Leonardo da Vinci called poetry painting that is felt rather than seen. Today, poetry is experiencing a renaissance in the U.S. Readings and book sales are on the rise. Two former poets laureate talk about poetry and its future in America. The Diane Rehm Show, next hour. And welcome back. Christopher Plummer is with me, an acclaimed Shakespearean actor known to the world as the very stern Captain Von Trapp in The Sound of Music, but far, far more for his glorious portrayals on stage. His new book is titled Christopher Plummer, In Spite of Myself. Here's an email from Jan in Little Rock, Arkansas. Please relate the embarrassing moment when you were trying to find your way onto the stage when it was totally dark and you were unable to locate the entrance. It's just about the funniest story I've ever heard.
Oh, God. No, well, it wasn't the stage. It was the television. It was early television when everybody was... It was live, of course. And we would do shows every week. Philco Playhouse, Kraft Playhouse of the era.
I remember them.
And this was a half-hour program. I can't remember its title. but it did small versions of great events. And I was playing the Archduke Habsburg, and Vivica Lindfors, a Swedish actress of great beauty, was playing Maria Vecchera, their famous suicidal pact that brought death to both of them, the great passionate love story of the Habsburg dynasty falling to pieces after his suicide. And here I am in my uniform with all the medals on it, and I'm supposed to meet her in the lodge on the estate. And I come in through the door, and there she is waiting for me, and we embrace. And of course, I couldn't find the entrance because it was absolutely black, and there was no floor walker to help me, or no stage manager. They called them floor walkers in those days, to help me guide the way. And I said, "What the hell?" I knew I was late because there was silence on the set. Oh, my God, they must be playing music now. Piping music into people's homes. Where is this? And suddenly I saw a light in the distance, and I ran towards it. Oh, my God, it was an opening, and I burst in with my medals and everything. And there she was, Vivica, looking absolutely livid with rage that she'd been kept waiting for so long, until I realized, of course, that I'd come right through the fireplace.
Oh, no. Oh, no.
The producer afterwards, who had a wall eye, unfortunately, whenever he looked at you, you thought he was giving you hell, screamed at me. He said, what'd you come through the fireplace for? I said, you're goddamn lucky I came through anything, you great schmuck. So, of course, I never worked with him again.
All right, we're going to open the phones now. Let's go to Oklahoma City. Good morning, Najeed. You're on the air.
Good morning, Diane. Thank you so much for taking my call.
My pleasure, sir.
What a privilege you've allowed me to address Mr. Plummer. Good morning, sir, to you.
Good morning, good morning.
I have to say that I have a special affiliation with your career in the sense that my wife's favorite movie is The Sound of Music, and my late mother's favorite actor was yourself. And if she knew, if she were alive and she knew that I was talking to you, she would certainly have teared up. She also, unfortunately, died of a stroke like your own mother. I had a very quick question, if you don't mind. I had the privilege of watching you on stage doing Barrymore in Detroit, Michigan, some years ago.
Yes.
And I was wondering if you could comment on the special challenges of doing a play where it is essentially a monologue, as opposed to a more conventional play.
Well, it's funny you should mention that, because I think the theater is actually going back more and more to plays that have confrontation with audiences. I find there is an opening now where the soliloquy is about to become fashionable again, and I think it's terribly important. For too many years, playwrights have written feverishly good works and place them in the hands of certain actors and directors who are terrified of disobeying the rules of the method. So they rather overindulgently play as if the whole thing is a secret. And there is no give and take anymore between the audiences in the sort of some of the kind of modern productions and contemporary productions that we've seen. So I think they have become fed up with this and are starting to do more, not just one-man shows like Barrymore, but two or three people shows, and more designed to engage the audience. And that takes us right back to the Elizabethans, doesn't it, when the theater flourished in such a gorgeous way, and people, and Shakespeare and Johnson wrote soliloquies that were meant to speak to the audience and relax them. So as far as a challenge in Barrymore, it wasn't. It was an opening. Mm. It was a release. And I think the audience is the most important partner you have when you're on the stage.
To Aline in Oroville, Washington. Good morning. You're on the air.
Good morning, Diane. Thank you so much. Mr. Plummer, I discovered a program as I was sorting through my drawer that you had appeared in The Dark is Light Enough with Catherine Cornell and Tyrone Power, and I believe that was in Detroit.
Yes.
So that must have been the beginning of your career,
yes,
or close to it.
Yes, not quite. I'd done quite a lot before that, but I was certainly working my way up the ladder, because I was playing the second lead, Tyrone Power, in that particular production, and I was dying to do something to poison Tyrone Power by putting something in his drink or something, because I was dying to play his part, which I thought I was much better suited for.
There's actually a photograph of Tyrone Power in the book, as well as Catherine Cornell.
And of course, he was the sweetest gent of all time. I mean, I adored him as a person, but I could have killed him as an actor.
He died quite young.
Yes, he died when he was actually in a sword flight in Solomon and Sheba, a movie he was making, and also because he had to lift Gina Lollobrigida, who was rather ample at the time, up a flight of stairs, and they did on the same day. They did so many takes that he went into his portable dressing room and lay down after lunch and didn't wake up. He'd had a heart attack, I think.
Wow.
Poor Tyrone.
Wow.
Yeah, he was a sweet man, and I don't mean to sound absolutely ungrateful, except I could have killed him.
All right, let's go to Irving, Texas. Tamara, you're on the air.
Hi, Diane. First, I want to thank you very much. I love your show, and I listen to it every day.
Thank you.
And I want to... Oh, yeah. And I want to thank you so much for bringing Christopher Plummer onto your show. I mean, you, sir, are one of my most favorite actors in the world.
Oh, thank you.
I, of course, first saw you when I was 10 years old or something, you know, in The Sound of Music. And I flip through the channels and I find your face on different shows, and I stop everything.
Okay.
To watch you.
Thank you.
My most favorite, of course, is The Thorn Birds, your intuition and insights about the struggles of Ralph DeBrickasaw. Ooh. Oh, my goodness. The looks on your face. Oh, sir. I mean, it's such a knowing, you know, look every time. And I have the, you know, of course, the video and stuff, and I watch it constantly. It's like 100 times a year I watch that movie.
Oh, that's great, Tamara. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Talk about the Thorn Birds, Christopher.
Well, you know, that's strange. It was very discombobulated because it took such a long time to shoot. And my friend Daryl Duke did a beautiful job of directing it. But they were shooting it all over the place in Hawaii and Los Angeles. And I think we used the Los Angeles Town Hall for the Vatican but at one point. And I was playing the Cardinal, which was very high up on the... A lovely part, actually. A lovely part in the book and a pretty good part on the screen. And I was thrilled to be playing that. And I liked Richard Chamberlain very much. He was such a serious, good actor. And Rachel Ward had just become a great beauty and a terrific actor.
She was marvelous
Now she's a happily married lady. I think she's given up the whole thing. I don't see her very much.
And Richard Chamberlain?
I don't know where Richard is.
All right.
But I loved playing that role.
I want to ask you one question about The Sound of Music.
What's that?
Why did you dislike being so associated with that movie so long?
No, it wasn't. It was because here's the thing. You work very hard at doing what you think are the great roles. And even on the screen, roles that are intelligently and well written and provocative, what have you. And then the biggest thing that you're remembered for is a role which was not particularly exciting, not one of my favorites, which is always a disappointment. I don't think I'm alone in that. I think a lot of people have been remembered for things that they don't particularly think they were great or marvelous in. I think Clark Gable resented terribly being always associated with Gone with the Wind. Thou listen, Scarlet. I mean, I remember when I was in Austria, somebody introduced me to a cousin of Baron von Trapp's, and I went with an interpreter. He was working with stone in the fields, actually. He was a bit of a peasant, and I went up to him, and I asked him through my interpreter what he had thought of. Had he known Baron von Trapp? And if he had, what did he think of his uncle or cousin? There was a long pause, and the German interpreter turned to me and said, He said he was the biggest bore he'd ever met in his life. And I must say, I took him by the hand and said, I couldn't concur with you more, dear boy. It's great to know you. Thanks.
Quite a story. Sort of sums up your entire feeling.
Well, I love Julie. I've got
yes,
to say that.
She's
I adore
wonderful.
Him, and it's her movie. And I loved Robert Wise, who was a stunning director and a true old gentleman of the old school, of the old Hollywood school that not much of them exist anymore. And so there were things about it that I enjoyed and will be proud of remembering.
Such as?
Well, their work and my friendship with Julie. And the score. I mean, there's nothing wrong with Hammerstein. And my God, that was extraordinary. Rodgers and Hammerstein music, which I've loved all my life. It was just the over-sentimental subject matter that wasn't my particular cup of tea.
But you were wonderful, I have
well,
to
I tried
say.
Well, I tried hard. It was harder than playing Lear, Hamlet, Macbeth,
really?
All rolled into one. Of
really?
Course, of course, because there's no... It was bare bones. There was no flesh on this role. And although we tried hard, it was rather difficult.
At 7 minutes before the hour, you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show and to Miami, Florida. Good morning, Ronald.
Good morning, Diane. Thank you so much for taking my call.
Certainly.
So I had one simple question. Being an actor myself, I always find myself looking for some type of inspiration from my life. And I heard you talking about the type of passion you saw Amanda display on stage. I wanted to ask, do you think that passion is reflected somewhat maybe genetically or the fact that, you know, you're an actor, she's an actor, or do you feel that that passion is found in her life and in her own experience?
Yes, I think the latter, because I that's why I was so astounded when I watched her that I couldn't identify from whence it came. And then I realized it was her own personality that she'd been forced to form on her own because her parents had rather neglected her shamefully, Tammy and myself both. And here was Amanda finding her own little world, and all that power and passion and frustration perhaps came out of her original part of her. Nothing to do with us at all. That's a very good question.
Has she gone on to continue with her acting?
Oh, God, she's always working somewhere. She's wonderfully crazed, of course, and she's always off somewhere in Bulgaria or Yugoslavia making a film.
Do you stay in touch with her?
Yes, I do. She calls me every now and then, but I never know where she's calling from. It's some outlandish country somewhere. And she wants to always become a citizen of each country she's in love with.
And speaking of that, here's an email from Angela, who says, because you are from a Canadian political family, I'd like to know what you think the American people or the United States could learn from Canada. Where does Canada get things right? And thank you for your contributions to the arts and for making Canadians proud.
Oh, is this a Canadian writing or an American?
She doesn't say where she's from.
Well, I mean, I just want to say that Canada doesn't get things right. We always complain up there just as much as we complain down here. And we have a prime minister at the moment who is taking just as much flack in his way as our last president, George Bush, took in his way. So there are great similarities, even though there's a parliamentary system there which is different from our party system here. We all make the same damn mistakes. I think there are certain things that Canada has learned about drugs and pharmaceuticals that is a little bit more sophisticated in the United States because it simply doesn't have the astringent laws that this country has. And they welcome new changes without taking what this country feels are huge risks. They are liable to proceed with a little bit more courage in that field. But that's the only thing I can think of that is really different. We're all human under the skin, and our politicians remain perhaps subhuman, but somewhere along the line, likable by God.
Oh, likeable. What are you looking forward to?
What am I looking forward to? Ah, that's a very loaded question. I am looking forward to, as I think the world is looking forward to, and I know the world is looking forward to it because I've been in Europe, is the new regime here in the United States. But we are so proud of America for doing this and for getting this change into motion.
Christopher Plummer, his new memoir is titled In Spite of Myself. What a pleasure to talk with you.
Oh, you're great, Diane. It's lovely to be on your show. Thank you. Thanks so much.
And thanks to all of you for listening. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, Tanya Weinberg, and Susan Neighbors. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dori Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and CD sales, transcripts from SoftScribe, and podcasts. Call 202-885-1200 for more information. Our email address is drshow@wamu.org. This program comes to you from American University in Washington. This is NPR, National Public Radio.